You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Well, thanks for having me here. It's fun to come to a room where I'm really not the most impressive person here, so I'm really looking forward to getting to the Q&A, which will be a lot more interesting than what I'm going to talk about. When forced to give a title to what I'm going to talk about, I came up with the values of technology. I'll spend a little bit of time talking about the Obama campaign, because it's pretty much why I'm here, or why anybody would want me to come speak to a group like this. And then quickly get out of that and talk about sort of what's worth learning there for advocacy in general. What's repeatable? What are the kinds of lessons that I think people should learn from what we did well, based on my perspective? And then talk a little bit about sort of implications that the technology has, and that what we did on the campaign and what I'm doing now, how that can impact U.S. foreign policy, international diplomacy, international advocacy, which is some of the stuff that I've been engaged with a lot recently. And I'm going to try to keep this short, and I'm going to talk about a whole bunch of different stuff and then let the Q&A sort of dictate where we go and what we really talk about, because the Q&A will, like I said, be much more interesting than what I start with. To start with OFA, Obama for America, in the bio and in the introduction, and being the most technologically advanced presidential campaign in history, that is true for every presidential campaign. So that is a little bit of sort of a strange compliment, because a lot happens in 4 years, right? It's between the way campaign cycles work. Whoever is the latest campaign is almost, unless they're really not trying, is almost certainly going to be the most technologically advanced. And I think we did things to take that and run with it. And I think we tried pretty hard to use the internet in mostly intelligent ways and certainly innovative ways. But I did want to sort of temper that statement with some reality, which is that that's always true. The other thing about that I sort of always start when I talk about the campaign is that people get really excited about some of the metrics that we ran into, 13 million person email lists and some of these other things. A lot of that had nothing to do with me or with Joe Rosebars, who was the new media director and my boss at the beginning of the campaign, or the other hundreds of people who worked tirelessly for 2 years to make the campaign happen. It was a very unique moment in history. And the thing I think that from a tactical perspective we probably did best was, we used to joke about catching the rain. There was a movement going on. There were people who were desperate for a kind of leadership that sounded different than what they'd been hearing. It was, you know, with President Bush and his second term in office, we were in a position to capitalize on just a national feeling that it was about capturing things and not about, we didn't have to create momentum, really. We didn't have to create passion. We had to empower people who were passionate, which is an easier task. And it's important to sort of think about, you know, people say all, you know, ask me all the time, like, I want to do what you guys did on the campaign. And some of the things are, and that's what I'll talk about now, some of the things are repeatable, and there are some lessons worth learning, and some of the things just aren't going to happen for other organizations, nonprofits. If we gave our 13 million person email list to another nonprofit, they're not going to raise $500 million. It's not going to happen. You don't have the same kind of urgency, you don't have the same historical moment, you don't have the same figurehead, unless you also have President Obama, who's, regardless of your politics, is a spectacular campaigner. Gifted in all sorts of ways that made our lives very, very easy from a strategic perspective as communications people and new media people. I started with the title, The Values of Technology, and I'll get back to that. I think that the thing that was best about the campaign, somebody's jacket's ringing, that was best about the campaign wasn't that we used any particular tactic well. People get really caught up in the tactics. You guys did great things with Facebook and Twitter, and you were the first to do this. The tactics are very mutable, right? The tactics change constantly. There will be new tactics in 4 years or new tactics now that didn't exist when we were running the campaign in 08. When we first started the campaign, hey, William, I'm going to admit this on something that's being webcast. The guy who ran our social and mobile program, Scott Goodstein, came to me and said, we should start using Twitter. And I said, really? You think that's going to be big? Because it wasn't that big a deal. And I was kind of like, I looked at Scott and sort of kind of looked at him askance and wasn't really sure about it. Turns out to be a pretty big deal. And I'm glad I listened to Scott because he's very, very smart. But the tactics are mutable, right? The tactics change. The thing that we did well on the campaign, and this was far outside of just the realm of new media and technology, which is the world that I sort of lived in for the 600 and odd days I was on the campaign, is that we had a clearly articulated set of values that everything we did flowed out of. So everyone on the campaign, everybody who watched the campaign understood the values that were most important to us. And there's a lot of sort of pushback around the Hopi changey stuff. But people understood what we were about. And this is not something to be overlooked, because this is something that good communications people forget to do, which is there is a progression in my experience in organizations and in advocacy and in communications from values to mission, from missions to strategy, from strategy to tactics. And people get really excited about the tactics because that's what everybody sees. So you have Twitter and Facebook and shiny, happy, millions of dollars and lots of money coming in over email. Email is the new big thing. I called email. That's really funny. Those are the things that we executed well, and I think we had extremely talented. We had an unbelievable team of extremely talented people, like Steve Gear, who ran the email program, and Chris Hughes, who did all of our internal online organizing, and Scott, who I mentioned before, and Joe Rosebars, who is the new media director, who is as good as it gets when it comes to online strategy. Period. Very smart people executing really, really well. But back to the thing that matters the most is we were all working from a shared set of values and we all knew what we were about. And so every time we went to figure out a strategy, we knew what we were acting from. We didn't have to reinvent it. There wasn't some question about whether, are we going to do an event that's about big dollar donors or small dollar donors? This is not a question. It was baked into part of who we are. And I think those decisions that got made really, really early on in the campaign, at the highest levels from President Obama and David Axelrod and David Plouffe and down from there, were the most important decisions that got made on the campaign. The things that I'm going to talk about now about sort of how we took that and took the values and the mission that they pulled together and created a strategy and a set of tactics that worked, were empowered by the decisions and the willingness of people like David Plouffe to see the value and trust in the possibility of technology and being willing to innovate in sometimes unusual ways that required some convincing, let's say. I think within that framework, the things that are worth learning about the new media program in particular are the importance of being genuine. That you cannot fake who you are. You can try, this happens a lot a good example from the political world is when an older candidate tries to sound cool. Does that ever work? It never works. I mean, there's PSA campaigns all about how parents always sound like idiots when they try to talk to their kids, right? This is like a known archetype, and yet politicians try it out every year and try to sound cool. And it doesn't work, right? It's just disingenuous. It's not honest. It doesn't sound right. People in a large mass can be fooled, but an individual has a very good bullshit meter. And when you're not genuine, you can't. Campaigns, in the end, and advocacy programs, in a lot of ways, are vehicles for people's ambitions and for people's values that they want to project into the world. if you fail the genuity test, fail at being genuine, you will lose the ability to make an emotional connection with your followers, with the people who are your supporters. And once lost, that's very hard to get back. And it is the power of the organization. It was the power of our organization, without exception. And that leads into one of the mottos we had. Particularly, this is the team motto in Iowa was respect, empower, include, which was a really important piece of how we interacted with volunteers, how we interacted with local officials, local experts. That we understood coming into Iowa, and we were all over Iowa, right? We had 33 offices in Iowa during the primary. It's insane. There's only 99 counties. But we understood that we were visitors, and we tried to become part of the community, and we came and engaged in a way that was meaningful and respected the people that were on the ground, and that empowered individuals at the bottom of our organization to take control over all sorts of aspects of our campaign. And this is the next thing that I think is extremely important, which is be generous with ownership. Communications people in general hate letting go of control, right? Message control. This is like, especially I talk to corporate clients sometimes about some of this stuff, and they're like, well, if we have comments, people will say things bad about our products. And it's like, yes, they will. They say those things anyway, you know that, right? That now you have a chance to participate in the conversation, and maybe you can respond, or maybe you can learn something about your product. They don't often like that idea. They prefer silence. Being generous with the ability to empower your supporters to be your best advocates. People, this is sort of marketing 101, right? That people trust other people about you more than they trust you about you. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Too many use. I got to figure out a better way to say that in the future. But we get the point, right? Is that someone is more likely to listen to someone they know and trust already than a brand or a candidate about themselves. Because of course, the candidate thinks he's good, right? And of course the brand, they like their brand, right? They're themselves, hopefully. Self-hating brands is a whole other problem that I won't even talk about. But giving away control means you have to teach your values, right? This goes back to the values thing that I talk about all the time. Is that if you teach your values to your volunteers and to your supporters, and instead of telling them what to do, how to do, give them tools to act and sort of teach them the set of values that you want them acting from, they're going to do the right things. They are not interested in harming the organization, right? They're going to make some decisions that you wish they didn't make, and they're going to say some things because they're not professional communications people, right? Or volunteers, right? If they were professional communications people, they'd have your job and you'd do something else. So it's not perfect, but they are they will pass the genuity test better than you will. And that's a really important thing. And driving, one of the things that we did well with technology was help drive the field program, which is really where we won, particularly in Iowa. But certainly in a lot of the later contests in the primary as well, this was a campaign that was won in the field. It was not a campaign that was won online. The thing that is impressive about our metrics is not that we had 2 million Facebook supporters. It's that half of them did something offline. Half of our Facebook fans volunteered or gave us money. Now, that's not an exact number because the data integration is really painful, as you guys know, but somewhere around half of our Facebook supporters, which is amazing. I'm very proud of that number because that means that these people who are casual, I'm a fan of you, we were able to engage those people in a way and be generous with control of our message and what we wanted to do, that we empowered them to go out and be our best advocates. That's something I think we did really well. That goes back to the next thing I was going to say, which is participating with people. When you're in a social network in particular, you're in a relationship with someone, right? When we started the campaign, Facebook fan pages didn't exist. We were just a profile, like everybody else. So we were literally like everybody else. So you have to act like it. When someone asks you a question, you should respond, right? You know, if you're in a relationship with someone, you need to treat people with respect, and you need to respond to people and converse with people. And the internet is good for dialogue. It's what it was started for, right? Right?
Yes. It's before my time.
How's that going?
Doc, for branding purposes, it would be for conversation, not dialogue.
Okay. So the last thing I'll say, I want to wrap this up because I want to get into some of the other implications, and then I want to get into Q&A because I want to stop talking. The last sort of strategic thing is tell good stories. Narrative matters, and being able to tell a good story that is over the life of your relationship with someone is important and is a difficult challenge. There are a lot of talented people in the world who can write one good email. There are not a lot of people who can structure an email program that lasts 2 years long that keeps people interested. It's a different goal. Being able to do it once is a skill and is an important one, but being able to craft a relationship with someone via language is a whole different animal and is really, really important. So all of these things add up to, I think the Obama campaign in the end was a really good object lesson in technology serving purpose. I say this a lot. I was at the Alliance for Youth Movement Summit in London a couple weeks ago. There's this big mantra about technology is a tool, right? Technology is not the purpose, right? Technology should serve a purpose. When you talk about advocacy, when you talk about international advocacy, when you talk about anti-censorship, when you talk about some of these other big issues, technology should be, I believe technology should be a means. It is not, I'm not particularly interested in the business of crafting novel technologies for the sake of producing novel technologies. I think there are a lot of problems that can be solved by using the internet and technology well, but you have to start with the problems, right? And so technology as a tool, this is something that we did well. We didn't use stuff on the campaign that didn't help us. How does this help us win? This is my mantra. I used to sit all the time. I would sit and bang my desk. Somebody would come to me with some new thing and be like, how does this help us win? Because in the end, that's what mattered, was translating online and internet energy into offline action and eventually votes. So does this technology that we want to deploy, is it going to help us win this election? Because if it's not, I don't want to do it just because it's cool. It's not my job. That's someone else's job. And so I think I think about what we were able to do during the Obama campaign and looking out to listening to things like Secretary Clinton's internet freedom speech, which I think was amazing that speech happened and it was given the prominence that it was given and that it was given by a secretary. I think all those things are amazing. I think there are lots of problematic issues not addressed in the speech. I think a lot of the values things that I talk about that were so good about the campaign were utterly absent from that speech. I think that the hard and the difficult and the dangerous part about promoting, you know, one of the major goals of U.S. foreign policy is still democratization, right? That's a pretty complicated thing as your first goal, right? Democracies and democratic values are predicated on all other kinds of social institutions that may or may not exist in the cultures that we're talking to. And I think the idea that there's a liberal democracy just banging on the door waiting to get out in every country around the world is pretty myopic. I think there are a lot of countries where that's not the case. That doesn't mean we shouldn't support them, and there aren't ways that technology can empower those people. But going from, it's not always safe or a good idea to go from a restrictive authoritarian regime to an election, for instance. Election doesn't necessarily be the first thing you do. It's not the first element of democracy. It's just an easy public one. And then being a little harsh on some of these things, but I think it's important. And the internet freedom speech was a really good first step, but I think it's just a step. I think that solving access problems is a step toward promoting values. I think this is the thing I want to say about the internet freedom speech. If we really want to be about internet freedom, we need to make it a more partisan process. We are not just about generic freedom for everybody. We're about certain types of freedom. We like censorship in the United States. We censor all sorts of stuff. We just don't want people to censor political speech, right? We want free press. We want individuals to be granted individual power and individual autonomy. These are different than being against all censorship. We censor child pornography. We censor all sorts of things that we believe are dangerous to society and dangerous to children and and these other things. And so being more explicit about the things we value, I think is where we need to go with taking these tools that we used on the campaign and that people use all over the world in all sorts of amazing ways, and start to really clearly articulate what's the purpose, what's the value, what's the mission, instead of getting stuck in the strategy and tactics all the time. And that's where I'm going to stop, because I talked longer than I meant to, and I got through some of my notes, and I don't need to get through the rest of them. So I'd be really interested in, I've talked a lot about the Obama campaign, and some of the stuff you can probably tell I've said before, right? Some of these ideas are very fresh, and they're things that I've been working on lately, and I invite being challenged on them, because they're not as well-baked, and they're probably things that I have just said that I disagree with. So I'd like to sort of, discover what those are before I repeat them. So whoever wants to start, I'd be really interested in.
I just was wondering if you could not, I can't challenge it because I didn't understand enough about it. Could you talk more about the story, the story from beginning to end? What is a story when it's from beginning to end? And also, what are the steps that one has to do, even though most of us can't do it?
Sure. I think that when it comes to the sort of the narrative matters question and being able to tell good stories is that remembering...
What was the story?
The story on the Obama campaign was born out of President Obama's personal story of a community organizer from an incredibly diverse background who felt a sense of service to country and who felt like the country needed to be going in a different direction, and that he as an individual, and he wanted to empower other people as individuals to take on the mantle of that change and try to do something better than what we've had. And I think that what is important is remembering that each time you talk to somebody, it's you have a specific, when you're running an email, I'll talk about email. When you're running an email program, you have a specific goal, right? You're sending an email to, you're promoting a petition, you're trying to raise money. There's a goal associated with that individual email. But if it's not part of the wider message, it sounds like it's from someone else, right? You get the sort of clanging cymbal problem of who's this? I thought this campaign was about change and empowering individuals. Now you're sending me this fundraising appeal that's about large dollar donations.
Can you be concrete as to how you might frame it in that large dollar donation
email? We wouldn't send one. The Obama campaign raised a lot of money in $2,300 checks. Like this is a fact.
Okay.
But the part of the what was, we also raised an absolutely absurd amount of money from $10 donations from individuals who never donated to political campaigns before. And that was a really important part of being able to engage those people was an important part of our story. And so that's the part of the story we told. We did things like Joe came up with this dinner with Barack, which was an amazing idea that really, we took four low-dollar donors and flew them to a town, and they got to sit down and have dinner with the candidate, which is just unheard of. I mean, the candidate's time is the most valuable thing on a campaign, period. And so typically when candidates do things like that, it's with people who are going to get them $100,000. It's just sort of traditionally how candidates' time is used from a fundraising perspective. But this was, it was part of who we are. And President Obama loved this. It was told back to us. He loved the opportunity to sit down and engage and talk, and we would film these things because it was an amazing moment. And then we would always cut off the cameras for 15 or 20 minutes at the end so he could just talk to these people and ask them what they were, and he was genuinely interested in engaging people in a direct way, and that's how we wanted everybody to act. That's how we wanted our supporters to behave. That's how we wanted the staff to behave. And it came from him and came down through everybody in the organization. And so when you think about the story, in the summer of 07, when we were this crazy long shot with a funny name, right, we were telling a story about President Obama's personal story and how, which is very inspiring and very unique and unusual and sort of right for the moment. And he's so articulate and such a gifted speaker that we were letting him tell his own story as much as possible. But as part of building a movement around, you know, he started from the very beginning, even when he was still we were still doing bio stuff because people needed to know who he was, talking about this being of your campaign. We use that all the time, right? We the sense of ownership that we imparted to supporters started at the beginning. And so if that's going to be who you are, that needs to stay who you are. And I think it's more about, you know, when you see people know about how they make movies, there's a person on set whose job is continuity, right? That if a person had a cup in their left hand in the last shot, they don't have the cup in the right hand in the next shot, right? And that's part of what telling the story from start to finish is about, is that if you sent an email 2 months ago about something, you need to remember 7 months later that you sent that email, right? That, you know, in the same way that if you have a conversation with a friend that you haven't talked to in a while, and they forget everything you told them, that tells you something about how much they care about you, or that they're very, very forgetful. But it might tell you something about, and so as a recipient of as a supporter of a large organization, that tells you about your value. Right. If you don't remember what you've told these people, that tells them something about their value to you, which is not to be trifled with because they are exceptionally important.
Questions. One, I totally 100% agree with you, and that marketing and all these tactics sort of get overpowered, and I've seen it so much. Mm-hmm. So from the beginning, and probably some evolving players, I'm sure, in the course of this story, how do you get people on the same page, particularly those Twitter lovers and those marketing people who forget about the real bigger picture about setting values? That's the first question. The second question is, I'd love to hear some teachable moments, you know, some actual mistakes that you guys learned from in the process.
I got some doozies. So the first question first. I think it's about one of the things that enabled us to be successful with the internet and new media and technology on the campaign was that Joe Rosebars, I keep mentioning, was a director of new media, was a peer of the director of communications. He was not a subordinate. This was a really important structural thing that happened at the very beginning of the campaign, when the first people were first hired, is that Joe reported to Plouffe, right? Which meant that obviously the things we did communications-wise online were part of a larger narrative, and that that was created by the president, David Axelrod, and Robert Gibbs, who are exceptionally talented, but not online strategists, right? These are not this. They wouldn't be offended by me saying that. They're not. That's not their bag. But that Joe was able to, when traditional communications people who think in sort of message control ways think about online, they tend to think in broadcast terms, right? Which there are very few broadcast mediums online. And so it was important for us, who did understand new media and the technology, to be able to say no credibly, right? So we didn't, Joe didn't report to someone who was asking him to do something that was a mistake. That didn't happen a lot, and I think we had a good reputation as being a drama-free campaign, and I think that's pretty honest. I think obviously there's drama on a two-year campaign when nobody sleeps, right? People fight. But I think that in terms of, you know, the real process of getting things done, people learned from each other and understood what they needed to do for all of us to be successful was for everybody to do what they're best at. I said this is in my notes, but I didn't say it, which is do what you're good at. And so when you talk about how to get, you know, an organization believing in values instead of tactics, it has to start at the top, right? You have to get buy-in from whatever the top of the organization is, wherever the leadership of the organization is from, has to lead with values. And that's not everybody's comfortable talking in values terms, right? They think it's too emotional, it's too soft, think it's too fuzzy. I think that's a cop-out, personally. I think that's it's hard. I don't think it's too soft or too anything. Obviously, I'm sitting here saying it's the most important thing we did. But it's hard. It's hard to distill your passion into something that's easily articulated and easily understood. It's not an easy task, and something that people need to take seriously and spend time on. And that's the thing that I think a lot of people miss, right? And when it's a lot easier to go, oh, we're going to get on Twitter, we're going to do all these things, and it's it's easier to just get going, right? But sometimes you make decisions that are hard to unmake if you're not starting from a center point, if you're not starting from a center of gravity, knowing who you are. Knowing who you are is that the humility of knowing who you are is really important. I think it's one of the things missing from sort of the digital diplomacy stuff and the U.S. foreign policy is the humility of how complicated democratization really is, how complicated what we have in the U.S. as sort of messy as it looks, how complicated it is, and what a sort of amazing Jenga game we have going on here. I think that's an important thing to realize. In terms of mistakes, I said that from the very top of the campaign, they had a really strong sense of the value of innovation and being able to try stuff, which was great. Early on, however, when we only had like 3 or 4 new media people, I was the only person on the campaign who knew HTML for like a long time, which was bad, mostly bad for my sleep. But early on, we had to make a lot of choices about what we wanted to do and what we wanted to spend time on and what we had the resources for. And gradually, we, you know, as we had more success and we proved the value of what we were doing, we got more resources. But there were some things that we had this idea in new media that we thought a really good, genuine, sort of honest way to do fundraising was going to be to do genuine line item fundraising where the things that we needed, we would let people buy for us. And so we went through this incredible process of building a system and working with the budget people to literally figure out everything we had to purchase and then surfacing it for people to say, you're going to buy us a van. And then we'd like send them a picture of the van that we rented. It was really, doesn't that sound really cool? It didn't work at all. It didn't work. It was too confusing. And everybody's going, yeah, it's too confusing. Well, where were you 2 years ago? It didn't work. I don't know whether, I still don't know whether it was because we didn't execute it well or it was a bad idea, but it just didn't work at all. It turned out, you know, when we split test our emails, we tested this whole system with this really nice narrative that we spent all this time on, this system that we built against a t-shirt. The t-shirt won by a mile. As if everybody wanted a free t-shirt. We'll give you $30 for a t-shirt, of course, no problem. And this whole, so sometimes it's important to test. It's really important to be out in the world with what you're doing and what you want to try, because every organization has an echo chamber, and politics is the worst, right? Technology is pretty bad too. We get really like impressed with each other and with ourselves. We got this like great new shiny thing that's like everybody wants to try and everybody wants to deploy whatever. And okay, I mean, sometimes those new tools are really great and are powerful or amazing, and you should try them, but it's sometimes important to go outside of this room and sort of like ask my mom, you know, what technology, you know, she doesn't know how to work her laptop very well. You know, she's, you know, I'm the tech support, right? So I ask her about, oh, so we're going to do this thing. And she's like, what are you talking? She has no idea. I'm like, okay, maybe we need to rethink it. But I think that avoiding your own echo chambers, and this is another example of humility being important for leadership, is understanding when you're in one, right? When you're impressing yourself. And this is an idea when we came up with an idea that we thought was really cool, that we didn't really road test, I don't think, enough, and we kind of ran with it, and we thought it was great, and it sounds really cool, right? I still think it sounds cool. Maybe I'm the only one. And it just totally didn't work, because we didn't, you know, we didn't go out and get outside of our own heads. Maybe. Go ahead.
I had the good fun a couple of months ago to sit in on a class at the Kennedy School, and it was being taught by one of Howard Dean's online organizers, and he gave a long lecture, and at the end of it, one of the students basically said, near as I can tell, what this basically comes down to is get a lot of email addresses and raise money from them. To which the lecturer said, yeah, that's basically it. And I raised my hand and said, wait, you teach a class for an entire semester on this? And his response, which I thought was wonderful, was, it's kind of subtle. But I thought it was sort of wonderful that you know, basically, you know, you could sum up the philosophy of this and get a bunch of email addresses and get some money from it. I'm thrilled to hear you talking, because I think you've added a third thing to this, which is basically get a lot of email addresses, raise some money from it, and ideally be clear enough about your mission and values that you can let those people speak on your behalf.
Yes.
I guess what I'm curious is, I think there's an enormous amount of enthusiasm for using digital technologies, not just for political campaigns, but for social change as a whole. I think there's an amazing track record of being able to generate those email lists and increasingly to get those small donations. I think you guys did something really special in then empowering people to go a sort of step further and speak on behalf of the campaign. But there's a big gap between that and this larger movement building that I think a lot of us are hoping is going to start coming out of the internet space. I'm sort of hoping maybe you can bridge that a little bit for me.
It's a really good point. We had this the three M's we talked about a lot in New Media: money, message, and mobilization. And look, email's king for raising money. You want to raise a lot of money online, get a big email address, email list, and then be really, really good at, and have a candidate like President Obama. That helps too. But email is still king for online fundraising. I think you touched on the, and I talked about this a little bit, but I don't think I talked about it enough, was that I mentioned it with our Facebook fans, which is converting online interest to offline action are the most important metrics of an online program. Unless you have online goals, which not very many advocacy campaigns or political campaigns do. You can't vote online. You can't actually produce much change online, right? These are all have to eventually translate it in some kind of offline something, right? And so if your metrics don't measure that, you are doing the wrong thing. Well, you may be doing the right things, but you don't know. And so everything we did was predicated on converting people on an email list into an active, mobilizing people. And so that takes a lot of forms, right? That takes, building tools to allow people to volunteer easily online, right? One of the things that's really actually kind of an annoying pain in the ass about volunteering for a political campaign is signing up for a shift. Like, the same is really simple, but it's every field office sort of manages it differently. Every field organizer has their own process. And so this is a problem that technology can solve, but it's actually a gigantic pain. We figured out some good ways to do this and some ways that weren't so great, but we did this fairly effectively with a lot of different tools in a lot of different places, depending on how many field organizers we had and all these different things. We also had my.barackobama.com, Mybo, which was our own social network that allowed people to find each other locally, create advocacy groups around whatever their interest was, whether it was their demographics, whether it was an issue, people could self-organize. And this is a set of empowerment tools that allowed people to go out and do positive things based on their own energy and their own communities. Those are the kinds of technology tools that I think are really powerful. I think that from a sort of general advocacy perspective, those tools are the technology tools that I think are most interesting. I'm talking about Chris Hughes is working on a new project called Jumo, which is about sort of inverting, instead of organizations generating communities, he's going to generate a community and then bring organizations to the table, which I think is really, really smart. And I think Chris is a genius and he's a good friend of mine. And I think Jumo is going to be really interesting and really, really a cool opportunity for empowering individuals to engage in whatever way they want to. I think this is an important thing about engagement online, is you got to go where people are, right? We had the advantage of being on TV for, every day for 2 years, right? Most, advocacy campaigns don't have that, right? And so you got to go where your audience is. You got to go to them and figure out ways, all of these different things, whether it was email, whether it was Facebook, whether it was Glee, whether it was, whatever this, we were on every social network known to man, right? It was just a way to give people a door into the campaign. Come and join this movement, right? It was just a way to get people in the door, and then we give them all sorts of tools. And we gave away, we had field tools where it was powered by real voter data that were available online that, this is a lot of control that typical field organizations aren't willing to get rid of. And we were willing to take the risk of, sure, there's going to be some fraud and there's going to be some people who don't use it well because they don't understand it or the tool isn't perfect, which it wasn't. But the power of having individuals be able to do more things is worth the risk. We put our entire brand standard manual online in digital high-res EPS stuff. People created their own art, this was the kind of thing that drove the traditional communications people batty, right? like the brand management question here. Well, look, we had, you know, we were doing daily events with 25,000 rally signs. I think our brand was going to be okay, right? Like, we were drowning out anything anybody was going to do in their basement. But it let people feel like they were part of the campaign and that they could express this movement how it meant, how their passion needed to be expressed. And that was extremely powerful for people.
From the back channel, it's actually from Wendy Seltzer, who is here in the ceiling, and who, by the way, can't hear us. So some people can hear us, some can't. Just a note for the tech people in the back. She asks, what's your current favorite tool for listening to people, and how many of them do you actually hear versus make feel heard?
Huh, that's a good question.
Amen on that.
Yeah. That is a make feel heard versus actually hear is a really interesting distinction, especially when you start talking about things like 13 million people.
Yeah.
There are a handful of tools for sort of measuring social media. I think they're all kind of imperfect. I think, you know, there's things as sort of basic as viral heat. There's Swift River, which is the new Yushahidi tool that I tried to install yesterday and it didn't work because it's in an alpha, but that's okay. It's a little early, but I installed it on my own computer because I wanted to play with it before this thing and it didn't work. That's okay. I understand PHP bugs. I think that's a really interesting model. The Swift River's model is really interesting of sort of using algorithms to figure out what you should be listening to and what you should be ignoring is an interesting question here. The way that we handled this on the campaign was a lot of staff. One of the things I tell organizations is don't go into a social medium that you're not prepared to support. What that meant was support with staff and with resources that are meaningful, right? We had, by the end of the campaign, we had close to 100 paid staff in headquarters on New Media, plus people in basically every state in the country, plus a lot of interns. That's a lot of people. And a lot of the interns in particular were people who were helping us respond individually to people. So that not only did, you know, we did a lot of things to make sure people felt heard. So we would ask for people's stories, because individual stories and being able to, you know, connect your story with our story is a powerful way of sort of deepening people's connection. So we asked for people's stories all the time. And then we would surface some of them, because we just couldn't surface all of them. Sometimes we would just run, we had this running thing on our homepage of just people's stories. But even that was a little bit pared down just because of length and some other, and you know, there's political considerations. And so we would do things where people felt like they weren't talking to a black hole. So that's a good instance of a tactic for making sure people feel heard. The only way to make sure people are heard is to hear them. Mm-hmm. And that means a person, and look, I think there are probably some people in the world who think that President Obama emailed them. He did read the emails, but he wasn't, you know, sitting in the office with me cutting lists and sending an email, right? It's not what he was doing. And when you're asking a question on Facebook, you're talking to the staff. But you need a person answering a question. And that is a resource. That is a big question of how many people does it take to answer 13 million people's worth of questions. So be prepared. You're going to start a conversation with someone. You got to stay. You got to have enough staff. You can't have. I don't think you can have a really good, genuinely engaged social media program with a communications director and smart people. You have to have staff. You have to be the only way to make someone feel heard is to hear them. The best thing I can say.
The follow up?
Yeah.
And actually also follow up to the Dean comment.
Who was that, by the way?
Well, it wasn't specifically today. It was I'm
guessing. It was Hick.
Yeah.
So the Dean campaign 4 years earlier clearly didn't do some things right, because I understand they lost.
Turns out.
Yeah, it turns out.
Yeah.
I believe that their answer to the question, how do you make somebody feel heard, would have, because they didn't staff up to answer questions, which, you know, They instead went for lateral connections, so they were building social networks to allow mm-hmm. people on the grounds that people would understand that they can't all ask Howard Dean a question, you know, all what, you know, mm-hmm. 600,000 of them or whatever. And so they were thought that the right approach was to form horizontal connections and let people talk with one another. How do you see? But you apparently thought that that's not sufficient, and so you staffed up. What you
not sufficient is the right answer. I think that is a good tactic, and I think we did a lot of horizontal. You know, we had this.
Yeah.
You know, we had our own social network,
right.
which I do not recommend for most organizations. But it is insufficient because people do want to ask questions.
So in the course of your opening comments, you said that your mantra was, will this help us win the election? Does this help us win?
Mm-hmm.
One of the, I think, theoretical ideas behind the Dean horizontal connection thing was that this would provide a movement that would move forward, that would have benefit for governing, mm-hmm. As well as for the next election, I assume.
Sure.
Was there anything, how much attention did you pay outside of the mantra to building structures and a movement that would help govern?
It was part of, we were very aware from the very beginning that the campaign was a temporary vehicle, right? Campaigns, this is why I think government is more important, and I think it's a lot harder than campaigning, because campaigns are temporary. They are, and we were very aware from the beginning that the campaign itself was a vehicle to get to have the opportunity to then do what we really wanted to do. And so we were aware of these questions, and the Obama for America network and community became the Organizing for America network and community at the DNC, and is active and is doing a lot of stuff and is actually growing, believe it or not. There are, I don't know the net numbers, but they, and I'm sure that there's drop off from election year to people unsubscribing and things like that, but there are lots of new people engaging now in the community based around the sort of hard, difficult work of trying to govern and trying to actually create change. And that we talked about from the beginning, I think the important thing of the direct engagement and the sort of answering questions is when you only have horizontal linkages between people, people are only teaching each other, and you have no opportunity to inject your values into the system. People have horizontal relationships all the time without you. Where are you in the? And I think in the end, this might have been part of the problem with the Dean group and why they were so powerful post campaign, is because they weren't that associated with the campaign, right? I think that there's a challenging balance to strike, and we were conscious of this from a narrative perspective that the election was day one, was day one of n number of days, not day zero of a countdown, right? The election day was the beginning, and the entire network was built around that idea from the beginning. I mean, the whole goal was to be able to take on K Street, right? To change the way influence works with the grassroots approach, and it's, you know, healthcare passed.
Just a quick follow-up, because there has been a substantial amount of criticism that OFA was not carried forward mm-hmm. ambitiously enough, and that David Plouffe was brought back in recently in order to mm-hmm. Reinvigorate that. Do you share that?
Could they have done more? Maybe. I'm not going to badmouth Mitch or Jeremy Bird, who are the guys who run OFA, who are geniuses, and I think they're both incredible. It's harder to do advocacy and about around governing is boring, right? You've got, especially when you have this massive procedural thing going along in the way most of legislation is going these days, it's boring, right? Like, I love politics and I think it's boring. So what are you going to do for the people who, you know, who really want to see change happen but don't really have, they've got a life and they don't do this for a living and they're not interested in becoming, you know, the Senate parliamentarian. So how do you, it's harder, right? And it's not as sexy. There's this famous quote of you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. Well, that's really true. And I think, you know, Macon in the White House has found Macon Phillips, who's the new media director at the White House, and took over as deputy for me when I became the CTO on the campaign, who's very, very bright and has a talented team and really good ideas, is finding it harder to engage from a government. And there are lots of reasons why. Some of it is legal for Macon. In terms of OFA, I think that, look, David Plouffe is as smart a electoral strategist as there is in the Democratic Party, and the midterms are coming. I don't know that's why he was brought back now, but I sure would have brought him back for that if he would say yes. So I don't think that's a failure of Mitch or Jeremy's at OFA so much as, you know, it's game time. It's election time again.
To your knowledge, has the OFA or the campaign used new media in ways to promote grassroots level political organizing? And I don't mean about national political agenda items, but about local political agenda items. Because I know that was the beginning, right after the election, when OFA was sort of, you know, started, that was a promise that, you know, the energy that you had galvanized around the country would be used to get people locally involved, their school boards and their, you know, all of that.
I think that, I would say that that's probably an unrealized goal still at this point. I think it's still a goal, and I still think it's both possible and a good idea. I think this is a little bit of a resource problem where during a campaign season, when you have 100 people, like that starts to sound easy. We had 4,000 field organizers. We can do all sorts of local stuff with this gigantic army of people on top of all the volunteers. You go into the DNC and you're in an off year, it's a little harder to just have the resources to execute on that well. And I think that I don't know, my impression and my advice would in that situation would have been, don't do it badly, right? So one of the, you know, you don't want to, overpromising is one thing, but underperforming is worse. And so, being able to, if you don't have the resources to support local people everywhere, supporting only local people in a couple places is sort of bad. I mean, that's just, it seems like you're not, it makes you look like you're not trying. It makes you look like you don't have your act together. It makes you look like, do not care about me, you're going to start losing people in a different way than, we're getting there. We're going to get there, which I think is the goal. I don't work for OFA, and I don't work at the DNC, but all of those goals are still goals. Of the community certainly, and of OFA, I'm sure.
You talk about, you mentioned a couple of sort of mantras that people repeated to keep their eye on the ball, like the respect, empower, include. Are there other things that you sort of did culturally or managerially to keep everyone grounded in the values of the work within the headquarters?
Within our team, I mean, the how does this help us win was definitely part of it. There was a very strong, especially early on, and this came from Plouffe and all the way down, a focus on what are you doing for Iowa. Iowa was so key to the whole strategy that sort of there, we all, it's very hard to, if you talk to people from the Obama campaign, that everybody has a soft spot for Iowa. Like, I loved it when Northern Iowa won the other day. Like, I don't have any affiliation with Northern Iowa. But they're Iowans, so I love Iowans now. The Iowa caucus process is so crazy. But it was a big part of who we were for a year. And so that was a big thing. I think it's interesting that the managerial questions are things that I still think a lot about how we could have done things better. Campaigns are very challenging environments to... It's very hard to be a good boss in a campaign, because nobody sleeps. There's always too much to do, and everything's a deadline. Everything's an emergency. You never have enough resources. You always wish you could do more. So you're constantly in this. You got to stay away. You got to finish working on this. I need, you know, your staff's telling you they didn't want to go home and sleep, and you're like, you can't. You know, it's hard to be a good boss. And so I think a key there is. The values stuff that I talked about is not just external. Like, you have to drink your own Kool-Aid and you need to like it, or you're going to burn out, right? I worked on a campaign for 603 days. I have 5 days off. Like, that's not normal. That's not a good thing to do for your life. But it was worth it because I stayed grounded in, to me, it was worth it because I stayed grounded in what I was there to do. And this was why I got into politics, was to do something like this. And so it was okay. I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and fix the thing I broke on the homepage and go back to sleep, you know, whatever it was. And I think the values, I think the value stuff that I talked about externally is equally important or more important internally, to particularly in campaigns and in advocacy places where people need to be rewarded for what they do. Let's talk managerial, organizational strategy for a second. And in a campaign environment, people aren't paid well. This is true of nonprofits too. And they're overworked and they're under-resourced. So that's a recipe for making someone feel undervalued, right? Like, this person's not paying me, they're not giving me the resources that I need, and they're working me until I die. These people don't care about me. You have to find other ways to make sure people do feel taken care of, heard internally, right? Because there's a lot of grassroots stuff that went on the Obama campaign, but there's also a lot of top-down stuff like, we got to go. That's a nice idea, but we got to go. So stick in a box and we'll talk about it later. And you got to find ways to do that where people feel like that's okay and that they're still right. And so there's a lot of, you know, campaigns are, for people who haven't worked on campaigns, are just terrible things. And you got to take care of each other, right? There's a lot of the managerial, a lot of things. I think the good managerial stuff is being part, not therapist, but just sort of being able to take care of your people emotionally is really important. I mean, I spend a lot of time talking about values, which is talking about the emotional connections that people have with organizations, and the same is true of staff. You have to take care of people. Somebody back there.
I'd love to hear, I think part of what worked about the Obama stuff is that the values that you're saying were the core values and you guys stuck to them were also the values behind the functionality of some of the tools that you were really successful at using. And I wonder since then if there's been instances where you've sort of struggled with people wanting to use the tools, but their values don't match the values of the functionality.
That's an interesting question. I think your thought is right. I don't have a concrete example of that being the case, but I think that, you know, to go back to the question of localizing organization, you know, once you get away from, you know, the uber national deadline of the election, people care more about what's immediately around them. I don't know that our tools are election tools, right? And so we are constantly building them and growing them, and the platform that we use is getting better and expanding and all these other things to localize. But I think that there's a tension there between a national goal and a local goal. I think it's a tension that's being solved, and I don't think it's endemic. I don't think it's something that is going to destroy the system or the community or the network. But I think your instinct to ask the question is absolutely right, that their, you know, forms follows function a little bit. If you're really starting with a problem and you're building to solve a problem, and then the problem changes, you didn't build for that. So sometimes tools adapt, and sometimes, you know, somebody builds, you know, somebody makes champagne by mistake, right? And that's good. Everybody likes that. But not all technology tools adapt that seamlessly for using them a different way. Like, WordPress is a great example. It's built as a CMS system now. What? WordPress is a blogging platform. But you can use it as a CMS system, and it works, right? More or less. Depends on how complicated you're going to get, and there are limitations of any CMS system or any blogging platform. Content management system, which is ostensibly a much more complicated thing than blogging, a blogging platform. But yeah. WordPress has grown into some would say a fully functioning CMS system. And there, like I said, the limitations. But so that's an interesting adaptation. I don't have good examples of where and when that's true, but I think it's an interesting consideration when you think about technology solutions and a technology as tools, that if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Right? So you need to have more than one tool, for one. And you need to make sure, you know, if your problems change, your tools need to change. And that's being that nimble is hard for big organizations. It's why sometimes open source tools are so great, because the barriers to entry are so much lower. It's not invariably true that open source is better, but for a lot of times, for big organizations that need to be nimble, they can be really useful. For that reason specifically, because you don't have a, 9-month and multi-million dollar SAP implementation that you wish you could get rid of. Right? SAP's a great tool. It's an amazing tool, but it's not gonna. You can't take it out all that easily. It's like taking out pipe. Have you ever tried to put copper pipes into a house? It's such a mess.
Compared to the previous tools of the kind of this campaign, for example, the television, I think internet might be more interactions between the you and the kind of supporters. Mm-hmm. Do you have actually the same, almost the same kind of concern? Do you have any example that in this kind of interaction environment, you met some very supportive volunteers who has a kind of community and a lot of he himself supporters, and he supports perhaps President Obama, but he finds that some kind of values you are campaigning just not what he wants, and he just turn around.
Yeah.
And look at shut you, because the internet is so interactions. Mm-hmm. So by this way, how can you
is an absolutely real perfect use case. That's an absolute risk that exists in trying to operate based on the kinds of things I've talked about. I was talking about the internet freedom speech, but this is a partisan process. If that guy doesn't like your values, okay, go move on, talk to somebody else. And if he takes his 10 friends with him, you can't do anything about that. That's going to happen anyway, right? That is not the fault of the internet. That guy is going to get turned off by something else, and he's going to take his 10 friends with him regardless. So this is like, I was saying before about how businesses get worried that people will say bad things about their products if they allow comments online. They're saying those things anyway. It's not the fault of the comments. You just now get to hear it, which not everybody wants to hear. And with you're right, with the interactivity and the sort of the instant interactivity of the internet, you can turn that guy off faster, right? And he takes his other people with him faster. But look, if that's going to happen anyway, I'd rather happen now, right? I won't waste time and investment in a person who isn't going to support us, right? In the end, I don't think it's a problem of the tool. I think it is a problem that has surfaced more quickly because of the interactivity you're talking about. But it is a problem that it already exists and that it's a symptom you already have. You just don't know. And with interactive tools, you know, which, yeah. Like I said, sometimes you'd rather sort of go back to the pulling the wool over your own eyes and sort of pretending like it wasn't there.
Criticism or negative comments or feedback can be valuable in the sense that if it exists, then the praise and the compliments you get have some meaning. If all you field are the compliments, then, that's a little bit fishy. So the praise is only as valuable as the possibility to criticize.
I totally agree with that.
So you mentioned legal problems of using social networks, and we saw some problems with the iconic painter of the Obama
Chef Ferry.
Picture. But did you when you started to get people involved speaking for the campaign, did you get any copyright problems?
We were careful to educate people. I mean, part of empowering somebody is keeping them from hanging themselves, right? So like we spent energy and time, if people were going to fundraise for us, telling them what the limits were and how that it was going to work and teaching them. And sure, were there problems where people didn't understand the rules were too complicated or things didn't go perfectly? Sure. I don't think we had any, really severe. There was no point in the campaign where I was worried about what we were doing. There were times when, we'd run into trademark questions or, people would, the Chef Ferry poster thing came out way after the campaign. The image licensing questions, we, with the trust and the power we gave people, came responsibility for them to behave legally. And we told them that, right? That, look, we want you to be, and we had a pretty high bar for what it meant to be a supporter, right? Like, we were very upfront about the fact that just hanging out on the email list was not good enough. Like, that's bullshit. You're going to do something. Like, you want it, you really believe in this, you should do something about it. And that if you did something, taking control means taking responsibility for your actions. And so we solve this problem through education as best we can, right? Now, campaigns are imperfect. I mean, they had a team of lawyers, and I'm sure there were things that we messed up here and there and that we fixed as we went along, and we fixed them, right? I mean, that's why you have a team of lawyers, and volunteers don't have a team of lawyers. So, there are certainly risks involved in it. I think they're certainly mitigated if you educate your people properly and you teach your people properly and give them the right tools.
Very quick point.
Can you just compare the content that your team and all of the Obama's really team, including interns, have created, the content, and the totally volunteer kind of content, which is also supporting Obama?
Mm-hmm.
Can you compare the...
Compare them?
Yeah, the portions of...
Oh, how much? Quantify?
How much kind?
I have no idea. I mean, we produced a lot of content on the campaign. I mean, we, at one point, MSNBC calls us the most important media outlet in the world.
Yes, actually, my question is, how do you think it's now the stage is web 1.0 or mm-hmm. web 2.0 kind of campaign online? Because the 2.0, maybe most of them are user-generated kind of content, mm-hmm. but how do you... Can you compare these kind of
things? If I understand the question, I mean, I think that most of the content was still coming from the campaign. And I think that the big difference is that personal content tends to be more personal, right?
Yeah.
And that's the reason why it's good, because it's powerful, right? A person telling a story about their own life is more powerful than me telling a story about their life. First-person stories are more engaging. That's why you're supposed to tell jokes in the first person, right? We all saw Good Will Hunting. So I think that the importance of user-generated content, I think as the campaign's resources go down, the proportion of user-generated content goes up, mm-hmm. right? Because the user base is still just as passionate and interested in doing as much stuff as they were doing before, and there's less of a machine working on the campaign side. I think these things still... ideally work in concert. If the values are consistent and you're still operating from the same principles, the user-generated content is never dangerous. I think that that's a bold statement. User-generated content can be dangerous, but is worth the danger. I mean, I think that people aren't going to make the same decisions that you would, but they're if they're working from the same values and they're working with the right sort of ideas in mind, that they're going to do the right things. You got to trust people to do the right things. Otherwise, you can't do any of this stuff.
Time for one quick question. I know I would ask one. Your hand's been up for a while. So.
I'm wondering what kind of things did you do in the social networks that you were able to measure resulted in the most offline actions that you deem valuable?
That's such a great question. Measuring social media impact. When you figure that out, I will invest in your company. it's really, really hard. Measuring social media impact is seriously challenging. And it depended greatly on what the offline goal you're talking about is. Facebook is really, really good because of their whole event and calendaring infrastructure is really good for supporting events and getting attendance at events. Our text message program was actually really, really good for generating volunteers in terms of percentage of the response rate to text message requests for volunteers. We need volunteers at this place this weekend. Our response rate was really high onto our text message program. We had a lot fewer people in text message program than we did in email. But the response rate was much better. The only, the holy grail of sort of knowing which people are where and being able to measure all these things, we never got to it. We did a lot of things to try to measure who was where and who we were overlapping. And a lot of that was just by asking people, right? Because data, the data integration problem posed by social media and by campaigns in general is overwhelmingly complicated sometimes. And too complicated for a lot of nonprofits to even attempt. Some tools will help you, but in the end, you have these disparate data sets of disparate quality, and you're not going to match them all up. So you need to do what you can to try to measure things, and sometimes that's just asking questions of people, people who come to events, how'd you find out, and trying to extrapolate from anecdotal evidence into something that's statistically valuable. That's a challenge, right? This is getting some pretty hard math there, right, at some point. But that's the way you do it. But even though it's hard, you need to try to measure. That's the one thing I always end up saying, is that it's really difficult to translate. You know, attribution is really hard when you go online to offline. So who gets credit? They saw an ad, they saw a TV ad, they got an email. Who gets credit for them voting? Can you create some mashup algorithm of percentages based on their media market and how long they were on the email list? It sounds like a really fun project for a really good econometrics person. I think my head hurts thinking about the idea, but it's worth trying to do, right? Because in the end, you have to measure what you're doing, right? You can't operate with your finger in the air.
Thank you very much.
Sorry.